Make sure it starts. All right, it's starting. Okay, we're covering a lot of chapters today, but that's because we're not reading all of them. We're skimming the surface on some of them just to get the main points out of it. So today we're still in 1 Samuel, chapters 26 through 31. And this will end 1 Samuel, and then next week we're starting in 2 Samuel. Okay? So in 1 Samuel chapter 26, the reason I didn't want to make us all read it is it's basically David spares Saul's life again. You know, he spared his life in the cave the last time. Well, this time David went into Saul's camp at night, and Saul was asleep, and David stole his spear and his water jug, and then he went back a distance away out of the camp, and he gets up on the top of a hill, stands on a hill, and he calls out to Abner. If you remember, Abner was Saul's commander-in-chief. So he calls out to Abner, and he says, "You and your men deserve to die because you did not guard your king." And he holds up the spear and the water jug and tells Abner to have one of his men come and get it back. So once again, Saul does the same thing as before. He all of a sudden has a turn of mood, and he calls for David to come back to him, and he pleads with David, "David, my son, you know, come back to me. Everything will be well between us." Goes through that whole routine again, and then he says to David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You will do great things, and you will surely triumph." So then David went on his way, and Saul returned home, went his way, and that's where it was left. So at that point, we go into chapter 27, and in chapter 27, okay, David's kind of displaced right now. David's thinking about this, and he thinks to himself, and he says, you know, one of these days, I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. Because he's like a yo-yo. One day he likes me, the next day he's going to kill me. So this goes on and on and on. So what David does is he escapes to the land of the Philistines, figuring that Saul's going to give up now because Saul's probably not going to come and attack him in the enemy's camp. So he figured that was safe. So David goes to Gath, where Goliath was from, Gath, and he asks King Achish if he and all his men and all of their families can live in a part of Philistine territory. So King Achish says, okay, I'll give you this little portion. You can live in Ziklag. So they all go, the 600 of them, you know, their families there, they go to Ziklag, and David lived there for a year and 4 months serving King Achish and raiding for this king. David's compromising here. He's reasoned in his mind, and he's justified, this is the wisest thing for me to do. And so he sought that route. And sometimes the same is true for us, excuse me, as it was for David. You think that you can compromise and it won't affect your family. You do not live independently of everyone else. When you make a wrong decision, when you choose a course that is not God's plan, what He's chosen for you, it affects those who trust you. It affects those who depend on you. It affects those who look up to you and believe in you. It affects everybody around you. David, in making this compromise, here's one consequence from that. His choice, I don't want to say it, it created a false security. Okay? Remember now, he's going there to stay, to be secure, so Saul won't get him. So he's got a false security here. And it's also a submission to the adversary's cause. Okay? Why do I say that? Because David said to, he referred to himself as the servant of King Achish. I am your servant. So if he's his servant, he's now surrendered and submitted to that king's cause. And what's that king's cause? To destroy the Israelites. That's what he's after. But it really, it also ended up being a lengthy period of compromise. You know, sometimes we make a compromise and we think it's just a little short term. This is just going to be this way for a little tiny smidgen of time. And sometimes that time drags out longer and longer and longer, and we're caught in that. Now, what happened was every time King Achish asked David when he came back with his men from a raid, he'd ask him, you know, well, where did you guys go and raid today? And David didn't really tell the truth because he was being smart. He led King Achish to believe that he was killing the Israelites, going and attacking and raiding them. But instead, he was killing the Amalekites and the Geshurites and the Gerzites. And when the king asked him, well, who have you been killing today? Where did you raid? Oh, we raided in the Negev of Judah. Now, the Negev is the whole desert wilderness. Like if you were to look at Israel today, the whole bottom part of Israel would be what we call the Negev. It's the desert, it's the wilderness. And so there was Kenite tribes, Judah, and this one is new to me, Jerahmeel. Not familiar with that one. But they all were in this area of the Negev, so he would tell them that's what he's doing. Now, it wasn't quite a lie because he was raiding those three. Why did he choose those three to raid? They think it's because those three tribes had a reputation of being cruel to innocent people, treating innocent people extremely cruel. And so he figured he's helping everybody in knocking out these tribes because they raided the Israelites and they raided the, you know, Philistines too. So he's got this going on for him. So then we move into chapter 29. And I think you have verses 6 through 7 for me. Okay, go ahead and read that. Chapter 29.
So Achish called David and said to him, "As surely as the Lord lives, you have been reliable, and I would be pleased to have you serve with me in the army. From the day you came to me until today, I have found no fault in you, but the rulers don't approve of you. Now turn back and go in peace. Do nothing to displease the Philistine rulers."
So eventually the Philistines didn't want David and his men going into battle with them. They didn't trust them, you know. And so they complained to the king about it, and the king had no problem with David. He loved all the good work David was doing, but his people were, you know, really uprising against him, so he sent him back to Ziklag. So David and all his people are still in a safe territory. They're still in Philistine territory, but they cannot be part of any of the other stuff that's going on. They're kind of like ostracized in their own little group. And so David says to the king, "What have I done?" He hadn't done anything wrong, okay? He didn't do a darn thing to cause this. He did nothing wrong, and the king knew that he did nothing wrong. But this is a powerful truth for us even to embrace, that sometimes we have a key connection somewhere with someone. Could be a church, a group, people, certain people, individuals. And it's a key connection that you highly value. And then it all of a sudden dissolves for no apparent legitimate reason. You just don't understand why it happened that way, okay? And sometimes it's because the Lord is turning the hearts of men in the direction that he desires. And you've probably all heard that scripture in Proverbs 21:1 that says that the king's heart is in the hands, you know, of God, and he can turn it like channels of water. And that's what he's doing here. Sometimes God does this because he is in fact making it easier for you to let go and to move forward into your next assignment, which you never would do if you stayed right where you were. And sometimes we want to stay there, you know, like the little bird in the nest. The mother bird has to kick the bird out of the nest. Well, God does that to us sometimes, okay? But when that happens, if it's the Lord that's leading this, don't take the matter personally. Don't become bitter with those people or that person. Okay? Don't do that. As though they are rejecting you. Because they're not rejecting you. If this is something that God is stirring in their hearts and he's behind the scenes orchestrating it, it's because he has a better purpose for you and he's doing that. So in the process now, David's still in Ziklag, okay? He's living with the Philistines. What's another downside to this? He loses his identity because he's a man without a country now. He's a displaced person, as we would say today. Displaced. What is my mission? Where am I going? Who has my true allegiance? He is neither a Philistine nor an Israelite right now. That's kind of how it looks to him. Probably would look to you too if you were in that situation. And maybe you felt that way at other times. You might feel like you're maybe not a person without a country. Maybe you feel sometimes like you're, you know, a fish out of water, like especially if you've made a major move or something. And all of a sudden you're plopped somewhere else now, and you can't relate to anyone or anything around you, so you're really not fitting in and feeling productive or whatever and safe here, but you're still not back over here anymore. So it can be very hard. First Samuel 30, verses 1 through 6. Whoever has that, please read it.
David and his men reached Ziklag on the third day. While the Amalekites had raided the Negev and Ziklag, they had attacked Ziklag and burned it and had taken captive the women and all who were in it, both young and old. They killed none of them, but carried them off as they went on their way. When David and his men came to Ziklag, they found it destroyed by fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. So David and his men wept aloud until they had no strength left to weep. David's two wives had been captured, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David was greatly distressed because the men were talking of stoning him. Each one was bitter in spirit because of his sons and daughters, but David found strength in the Lord his God.
So David becomes depressed here. I don't blame him. I'd be depressed too. Her who were around me all of a sudden wanted to kill me. Okay, they, you know, his men don't trust him anymore. They want him dead right now. Okay, so what happens here? They're all mad, you know, the place got raided, their families are carried off and everything, they're mad, okay? But what should they be doing right now? What it should be, they aren't doing. Instead of planning a rescue, which is what they need to do, plan a rescue, let's get together and figure this out, okay? Let's make some plans. No, instead they're looking around for someone to blame, and it's David. So it's like, let's get him, guys. You know, it's all his fault. That's not going to get their family back, though. That's not going to help them. But don't we sometimes act that way? Sometimes we don't calm down, think about a plan. What can we do in this mess to straighten it out? Instead, we're like, well, you know, it's all their fault. I'm going to get even with them. Because it's our human nature sometimes. It's our sin nature. And that's what's happened here. But we're told, the last verse that she read, David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. This is the first time, as far as the scripture tells us, okay, in 16 months, that's how long he's been living with the Philistines. It's the first time in 16 months he looks up and he says, oh God, help me. During the 16 months, it's looked like he's pretty much been making his own decisions and choices. We have no record of him asking God anything now during this time. And just making decisions and choices, and it doesn't look like it's going too well for him. But now he's turning to God. And then in verse 7, David calls for Abiathar, the priest, and he tells him to bring the ephod. And we've talked in the past about the ephod. And, you know, David inquires of the Lord, and he says, he's doing the right thing now. See, he's not making his own decisions. He says, shall I pursue this raiding party? Will I overtake them? And the Lord tells him, pursue them. You will certainly overtake them and succeed in the rescue. So now David knows what he's got to do. Okay, now that's just like God. Go ahead, Carol.
I have a question. So the priest was with him in Ziklag?
No, it's David calls for Abiathar. We don't know where exactly he was.
Where the time lapsed.
Right. He might have had to wait a day or two, or we don't know that. We don't know that he was with him. He might have been.
Okay.
Okay, but we don't know for sure.
Okay.
David, normally he would go to the priest at the tabernacle and inquire, but he couldn't go there because the tabernacle is in Saul's territory.
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
So that's why he had to call then for the priest. Now maybe the priest was back at the tabernacle. I don't know. But remember, the ephod had the Urim and the Thummim inside the little pouch that they would use to inquire of the Lord. Don't know what it looked like. They looked like, but I always picture them like two little dice kind of things or something, you know? The yes and the no dice. I don't know. But instead of giving up in despair, David inquired of the Lord. He was in need of recovery. He did it all his way, and it's not turning out good. So he's in need of recovery. Now, with the word from the Lord, he set out, and this is where David could have missed a key component and a blessing in what laid before him that he didn't know was coming. He didn't know that his recovery was contingent upon helping someone else's recovery. Sometimes that happens to us too. Okay? In verse 11 of this chapter, it tells us the story, and we won't read it all, how as they're going on their way now to go and rescue the families, they come across an Egyptian slave. And this Egyptian slave had been abandoned by the same group that raided Ziklag and carried everybody off. David would obviously have been in a hurry. Every second mattered if he was going to get his wife, they were going to get their wives and children back. So they got to get going quick. They're in a hurry. They're in a rush. They've got an assignment to do, and they can't be distracted by anything or anyone. So it would be easy, you know, for David just to say, don't bother me. David was also an important man who was on a mission. So it would have been very easy for him to overlook this slave or ignore him altogether. And obviously, they knew he was a slave by the way he was dressed. So there was no guessing there. He was the kind, you know, in those days when they saw a slave, they considered that person to have less value in that day than someone else. Except in God's eyes. God never looked at someone and saw them as less value. So the slave would have certainly died had they not stopped to help him, because remember, he had been left there for 3 days. He had no water, no food. He had no provisions. He's in a very desolate place. He's got nothing. Perhaps this was a test of what was in David's heart. We don't know. Maybe. But David had eyes to see, and he had a heart of compassion, even in his own need of recovery. He's in this great need right now, but yet he's not blinded to someone else's plight in this moment. Now remember, at this point, he gives the slave food and drink before he discovered that he was part of that raiding party. So he didn't give the slave food and drink to get on the good side of him so he could get information from him, because he didn't know yet that he was part of that group. It was only after the slave had received the help from their hands that he realized the slave can be useful to him, because he had been with his master who was on the raid that carried off their families. So David promises not to harm him if he'll take them to the raiding party, wherever they are. So here we are, the very thing that looked like it would cause unnecessary delay. Now, how many times in life do you come up like that? You're in a hurry, you're in the midst, gee, I'd like to stop and help, but nope, I got to do such and such. Okay? That very thing that looked like it could cause an unnecessary delay actually became the very thing that gave them speed and advantage. They recovered everything. So you see how God's behind the scenes here, working. Because they could have wandered around for a long time trying to find out where they went. So maybe, think about this sometimes. Maybe you were one of those who was left abandoned in a field, symbolically. If you were, please forgive those of us who passed you by and didn't stop to help, because that was not the Father's heart. Or maybe you were one like David, that you were called and you were on a mission for God. Hey, you were on a mission. And in the need or the zeal of the moment, you didn't notice that one who had been abandoned in the field. You just didn't notice them. And if so, if that's you, then just ask the Lord's forgiveness for that. Now, because if you remember, I think it might have been brought up last week, out of the 600 men in David's group, 200 stayed behind. Okay, they stayed behind because they were really exhausted. So they stayed behind with the supplies. And because they did that, after the raid was over and they plundered the enemy, they not only got all their families back, but they plundered everything from the enemy, and they had all the spoils, and they didn't want to share the spoils now with the 200 that didn't go with them. They didn't think it was fair. But David said, nope, that's not the case, you know, that those who didn't go down to the battle but stayed with the supplies are going to get the same cut as those who went into the battle. That might seem unfair to you, but that was how David said it. And you might hear that a lot today. Maybe you've heard that many times in other churches, where that phrase, you hear it a lot with missionaries, because missionaries are raising support, and maybe you don't have the courage, or you don't have the opportunity to go somewhere else as a missionary to bring the word of God, but you can help by contributing. If everybody contributes a little bit, people can be sent. So when they do that, the missionaries will say, you know, those who stay back with the baggage, with the supplies, get the same share as those who go, in God's eyes. So what you're doing to send missionaries, God looks at that just as important as if you were the one going there. And I remember every time Ed and I had another mission trip to go on, we had to raise the funds, you know. And that's one of the things we would always put too in our, you know, our letters and our things like that, is that all of the people who contributed financially or contributed to be your prayer backup while you were there, those are the same value before God as the person who actually went, because it takes a whole team. Everybody's got their part. And that was what David was trying to get across here. You know, they stayed with the supplies. Too many times, the body of Christ is in retreat mode, in reaction to the enemy. The enemy does something, we go right away into retreat mode. When we really need to be in a pursue and overtake mode, plundering the enemy's camp, just like David and his men did, okay? Instead of living with a mindset of self-preservation, we should be invading territory. Now, that might be kind of an odd concept to some of you. You know, we as Christians are to be peaceable, loving, all those good qualities. But that doesn't mean we're to be doormats. And it doesn't mean that we're supposed to just hunker down and take care of our own. It's a completely different way of thinking. In Acts chapter 10, verse 38, it says, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and with power, who went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. Jesus was always taking territory everywhere he went. When he healed the sick, he was taking territory. He was taking that sickness that was in that person and giving them the healing. He took territory. They had been robbed of something. He took territory to restore what they needed. God calls us to invade and to have an impact. And invade sounds like a pretty aggressive word. And if you're a person who has a real compassionate gift, you have a hard time with that word. But don't. We don't need to wait around for something to happen and then react to it. But our actions, every one of us, should be making the enemy of God react to us. We are in a battle to see people restored to the Father, restored to their lives being restored, whatever is wrong in their lives, and seeing people made whole in the presence of Jesus. That's being aggressive, and it is a battle in a sense. Don't let the enemy set the stage. Make him react to us. That's why the Lord gives us power and authority and his word to use. Okay, now we're in chapter 31. And this is regarding Saul's demise. The Philistines were fighting against Israel, and they overtook Saul and his sons. And then the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, which were all three of Saul's sons. They're all dead now. Okay? The battle is growing fierce against Saul, and the archers hit him, and he's wounded critically. He's not dead yet, but he's wounded critically. Okay, whoever has verses 4 through 6, please read that. Is that you, Bridget?
Yeah. Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through. And these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me." But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. When the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day.
So why did he do that? You know, why did he want the guy to run him through with his sword? Because the Philistines had a real well reputation for torturing their captives. They were very good at that. Saul probably knew about Samson's fate with the Philistines. Remember, they gouged out Samson's eyes. They were all into torture. So, he didn't want to risk physical mutation being captured by them or any other kind of abuse. So when his armor bearer refused to kill him, he took his own life because he figured, I'm not going to have them do that to me. And then the armor bearer faced a moral dilemma at that point. Should he carry out a sinful order from a man who he was supposed to obey? He knew that he should obey his master, the king. Saul was the king. He gave an order. But he also knew that murder was wrong. So he's kind of like stuck in a bad position here. What's the choice, you know, he's going to make? And there is a difference between following an order which you don't agree with and following one that you know is wrong. There is a difference. So have the courage to follow God's law above human commands. When the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley at this point, Saul and his sons just got killed, the battle's not going well, they're over there, and then the rest of the army that was beyond the Jordan, they saw that the men of Israel had fled, and Saul and his sons were dead. They abandoned the cities, and they fled. They said, let's get out of Dodge. This is not looking good for us here. Okay, we're losing. So they fled. What happened when they fled? The Philistines came in and lived in their cities now. Philistines just moved right in. That's something that happens to us in our life. When we leave an opening, okay, they fled, they abandoned the town. We can leave openings to the enemy in certain ways. We can abandon certain things in our own life that you can't do that because the enemy will move in and take that territory. He'll take that territory the first chance he gets, and he'll hunker down and he'll establish a beachhead, and that's it. You got a stronghold you don't know what to do with. Well, the Philistines came in and lived in their cities. So then in verses 8 and 9, the next day the Philistines come to strip the slain. They, they found Saul and his three sons dead, and that was a normal thing in battle. that when you defeated the enemy, you took all the weapons and the equipment in the process. So you'd go and they'd rob the dead bodies. Because that might mean your own survival in days to come if the enemy all of a sudden rallies themselves again and the battle rages on. So whatever you take away, their troops cannot use against you in the future. And that was the logic in that. So what did the Philistines do? They cut off Saul's head. They stripped off his weapons and they sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of the idols and to the people of the land. Saul was dead. Here's the proof. They would all celebrate. They still did that in not too distant times here. I remember when we were in England and we were at the Tower of London, and you know, they would, it just even in the, you know, 1700s and stuff like that, they'd take the heads of the people they killed and they'd put them on a pike all along the bridges so the people could have fear struck in them. This is what's going to happen to you if you don't, you know, shape up. So that's not an uncommon practice. Okay, in verse 10, they took Saul's weapons and they put it in the temple of Asherah, and they fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Now, Bethshan overlooks the Jordan Valley. You can go there today. They've excavated it, and you can go there and you can see it was a pretty large place. You see, it was a, and you could go and see, sit where the theater was and all the different things. They're still excavating. You can even go there and join the excavation if you want to. So Bethshan was a pretty important place then. So they took and they put it in the temple of Asherah to put Saul's armor in the Philistine temple gave credit to a pagan goddess for victory over Saul. That was the whole symbolism behind them doing that. Asherah was a goddess of fertility and a goddess of sex. She was one that you'll read about a lot in the Bible. Ironically, though, Bethshan was really not that far from where Saul was inaugurated. It's almost like everything came full circle. Okay, his entire 40 years, he was king, 40 years. Okay, and in that entire 40 years, he made little headway territorially for the Israelites. He didn't go very far. He didn't take any new ground, so to speak. He wound up only a few miles from where he started, literally a few miles. Someone, however, did take pity on Saul. Would you read those last verses in chapter 31, 11 through 13?
When the people of Gibeah heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their violent men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they burned them, and then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days.
So Saul's death was also, not only is it the death of a king, it's the death of an ideal, okay? Israel could no longer believe that having a king like the other nations is going to solve all their problems. Remember how bad they lobbied for a king? They didn't want to live under the judges. They wanted a king. Well, they got a king, and it didn't turn out so good, because the real problem was not the form of government, but the sinful king. If a king would have not been so sinful, things would have turned out differently. Saul tried to please God by spurts of religiosity. Every once in a while, he'd throw God a bone, you know, just a little bit. Kind of like a lot of Christians that you know today that we joke and label them, you know, they're the C and E Christians. They come to church only at Easter and Christmas. So they are giving God spurts of religiosity just enough to stay in his good graces, okay? But the real spirituality takes a lifetime of consistent obedience. I want to make mention of a few points here on the board. I have two deaths contrasted. Beyond the great tragedy of Saul's life is a very interesting analogy between Saul's death and Christ's death. First of all, Saul's death appeared to be the end of all national hope. When Saul died, many people must have thought, that's the end of Israel. The Philistines will surely conquer us now. In a similar way, Christ's death appeared to be the end of all national and spiritual hope for his followers at that time. Once he was dead, they were lost, they were forlorn, because they had not yet come into the full understanding of what he had said to them, that he would rise again, and you know, and all those other things. And so everything went into chaos at that point for the believers. Put yourself in the place of those surrounding the cross. Jesus just died. Okay? Some of them watching from the safety of the shadows must have thought, there's no kingdom. He told us that he was going to bring his kingdom. There's no kingdom. He's dead now. We're finished. Others might have said, we believed in a hoax. You know, our dream was merely a phantom. We're finished. It looked like the end of all national and spiritual hope for the Jewish followers of Christ at that time. Second, with Saul's death, it seemed that the adversary had won the final victory. The Philistines got him. The Philistines marched in triumph, displaying the heads of Saul and his sons and dangling the bodies for all to see, probably shouting, "We won the victory!" When Christ died, it seemed as though the adversary of our souls had won. Satan might have even thought he did at that point. Satan must have strutted all over the gates of hell, declaring, "The victory is mine! I am the conqueror. The Messiah is dead." Third, Saul's death paved the way for an entirely new plan of operation and ushered in David's kingly line, which led to Messiah. When Jesus Christ died, a whole new operation moved into action and set in motion our great salvation. Fourth, Saul's death opened the opportunity for another who would not otherwise have been included in God's line of blessing, David. Christ's death graciously opened the opportunity of salvation's blessing to the Gentiles now, who would never have otherwise been able to enter and come boldly to the throne of grace. And the fifth, Saul's death ended an era of dissatisfaction and failure. Christ's death ended an era of law and guilt. You no longer were saved by the law and living in guilt. Christ ended that, introducing an entirely new arrangement based on grace. And lastly, Saul's death displayed the foolishness of man. Christ's death displayed, in human terms, okay, the foolishness of God. Through the foolishness of God's plan, he brings to pass the incredible. He takes the preached word and he changes lives because of his son's death. They bruised and they mocked the body of Jesus in the same way. But we all know who really had the final victory. Comments, questions? You've all been so quiet today. Carol?
I guess something that just struck me was that Saul reigned for 40 years. Even though right at the very beginning, it seems like God was saying, I made a mistake. I'm not made a mistake, but I regret, you know, this person. But he still reigned for 40 years. So that's, you know, I'm sure it's all about God's timing as far as getting David ready, getting, you know, just to fulfill everything. It's sometimes I don't think we see. Sometimes we think, okay, God, what are you doing? How can you take so long? But it's like, you know, he's gracious and merciful, and it's all about timing, about getting everything and everybody in their place for their own good. And so, yeah.
That's a very good point, because it is true. I don't know about you, but I know I get that way at times. I'll see people that, in my estimation, I think are really evil, and it just seems like you get away with murder forever.
Yeah.
You know? And then I'm going like, you know, like, Lord, why don't you just get them out of there now? You know, why are you letting them just get, more people are dying. This is getting worse. You know, the 40 years. For 40 exactly. years. Which is interesting, because what does 40 years represent all the time in Scripture?
A generation.
Think about it. It's like, remember what God had to do in the Sinai Desert when they were wandering around? They wandered 40 years. Oh, that one whole generation had to die off before they could go into the Promised Land. Why is that? Because it took them that long to get with the program. It might take us a whole generation to get with the program that God's trying to get us into to make the changes in our culture and in our world that need to be changed. Why does he take his time? I don't know. But I know sometimes part of it is it takes that long for us. Anybody else?
Well, he also has more time than we do.
Yes. That's true.
It does get better generation to generation. I was just talking about that this week.
That could be debated.
Well, like with family curses and things like that, like it gets better, I think. Well,
it can. Well, I want to go to God.
Yes.
But I agree with you, like the generation that happens within generation too. So.
Yes, and he gives us the opportunities and the tools to be able to make the changes better. But I think we all know, if you experience it, sometimes things have to get worse before they get better.
Oh. Carol? You know, I read ahead to 2 Samuel 4, and it says that David reigned 40 years as well. So
that's where we're going to be next time.
So it's like, you know, God's got something about these 40-year thing, right?
40 days.
Well, if you pay
years,
attention, if you pay attention to
a lot of symbolism.
The scriptures, and then what's going on in our world, and what's going on in the news, and what's going on prophetically, you'll see that God is a God of numbers. Everything is symbolic and means something in God's time frame. And when you can get onto that schedule and start paying attention, it's astounding. You know? Okay, next week, we're going to start 2 Samuel. And we'll be going to chapters 1 through 5, and we'll be going quickly through them like we did these today. So it's not like there's a whole lot of, you know, looks like an awful lot. But read what you can of it.